Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Bottom line up front, ongoing localized tactical operations in the Middle East are actively depleting critical U.S. munitions stockpiles needed for broader strategic deterrence. Concurrently, Russian military-industrial production has shifted to a wartime economy that is mathematically outpacing U.S. defensive interceptor manufacturing. As a result, strategic assessments indicate the U.S. must radically restructure its defense industrial base and adopt a two-war construct to maintain readiness against peer adversaries.
Okay, so with that out of the way, let's jump right into this deep dive. Imagine you're standing in your kitchen, right? And suddenly your stove catches fire.
Yeah, worst nightmare.
Exactly. So you grab the extinguisher, you're super focused, and you're just fighting the flames. But while you're completely distracted by this immediate localized crisis, someone outside is systematically and quietly dismantling your home security system.
Right.
You put out the fire, but your front door is wide open, and a much bigger threat is just standing right there. And according to a stack of newly released strategic briefings from mid-2026, that is basically the exact scenario the U.S. military is waking up to right now.
I mean, that visual of putting out a small fire while the house is compromised, it really perfectly captures the core dilemma highlighted across all these reports today.
Yeah.
We're looking at a wildly complex global picture, and we're pulling from three very different vantage points. So we have a comprehensive strategic analysis from CSIS, that's the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Sorry.
We also have frontline tactical updates from the Institute for the Study of War, the ISW, covering operations with both Russia and Iran. And finally, to ground all this high-level strategy in actual physical reality, we've got a really detailed piece of aviation reporting from the war zone.
Yeah, and the central thesis across all of these documents is that the era of isolated regional conflicts is just over.
Completely over.
The U.S. and its allies are facing this interconnected network. Analysts are calling it an axis of adversaries, which includes China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. So today, we're going to trace how tactical, localized actions in the Middle East are basically sending shockwaves through the entire global supply chain of munitions.
Yeah, it's all connected.
Right. And we'll explore the specific mechanics of how a fight in one hemisphere directly drains readiness in another, and why defense analysts are arguing the U.S. has to radically shift to a wartime footing.
Well, and to understand that global resource drain, we really have to look at the immediate physical commitments first.
Yeah.
The analysis starts with the ongoing 2026 conflict with Iran, which is officially designated as Operation Epic Fury. And that war zone report you mentioned gives a really visceral look at the toll this is taking.
It really does.
They tracked a squadron of 11 A-10C Warthogs from the 75th Fighter Squadron that just recently landed at RAF Lakenheath in the UK, returning from the Middle East.
And the imagery described in that article is just wild. Like, these jets are covered in fresh mission stencils, acting like a literal combat diary on the side of the plane.
Yeah.
You've got this super jarring juxtaposition of, like, passing pop culture references. There's a tiny Nintendo Diddy Kong painted on the nose.
Wait, really? Diddy Kong?
Yeah, Ridley, Diddy Kong, Star Fox, all sitting right next to stencils of massive secondary truck explosions and destroyed proxy boats.
Wow.
But the markings also list out the sheer variety of munitions deployed. They mention small diameter bombs, APKWS rockets, Melty decoys, and JDAMs. But for anyone listening who isn't a massive military aviation buff, what do those acronyms actually mean in a real fight?
Well, basically, they represent a highly sophisticated and, frankly, highly expensive toolkit. Take the MELD decoys, for example.
Okay.
These aren't explosive bombs. They're actually miniature, autonomous flying drones that the A-10 drops midair.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And once it's launched, a MELD mimics the exact radar signature of a much larger U.S. fighter jet or even a bomber. It flies around specifically to trick Iranian air defense systems into turning on their radars and shooting multi-million dollar interceptors at absolute ghosts.
That is brilliant, but sounds so expensive.
Right. And then, meanwhile, you have the APKWS, That takes old, unguided hydro rockets, literally the kind of cheap, dumb rockets helicopters have been firing since the Vietnam
Well,
War,
right.
and it bolts a laser guidance kit onto the front. So it turns a dumb rocket into a precision sniper round that can hit a moving, fast attack boat out on the water.
That's crazy. But, the most dramatic marking mentioned in the piece wasn't even a bomb. It was a stencil of an F-15E Strike Eagle
Oh,
tail.
yeah, the CRSAR mission.
Exactly. Accompanied by the green footprints of the Air Force pararescue jumpers and their motto, "So Others May Live." The reporting indicates this actually commemorates a daring combat search and rescue operation to extract a downed Strike Eagle crew over Iran. The A-10s flew top cover for that, and one was even heavily damaged by Iranian fire, though the pilot miraculously managed to nurse it back home. I always think of the A-10 as like a flying titanium bathtub, you know?
It's pretty accurate,
It's
actually.
incredibly slow compared to modern stealth jets, but it's engineered so that even if half the wing gets blown off, the pilot can manually cable steer the thing back to base.
But why, I mean, why is a Cold War era jet still the platform being sent into these incredibly hostile rescue missions in 2026?
Well, the survival of that specific aircraft in such a modern threat environment speaks directly to its design philosophy. It was built around that massive GAU-8 Avenger rotary cannon and a heavily armored cockpit, specifically to linger low and slow over a really chaotic battlefield.
Oh, because stealth jets can't do that. Exactly. Stealth jets rely on not being seen, which means they have to fly high and fast. But when you have a rescue helicopter hovering over hostile territory trying to pull a downed pilot out of the dirt, you need an aircraft that can stay down in the mud with them. You need something providing sustained, highly visible, and just overwhelming suppressive fire. But that gritty tactical fight is absorbing immense U.S. resources right now.
For sure.
And interestingly, the June 13th ISW report on Iran suggests this conflict is actually entering a weird, highly tense transitional phase. The U.S. and Iran are currently negotiating a memorandum of understanding in Mo to effectively pause the kinetic fighting.
But I mean, keeping those A-10s in the air, fueling the rescue helicopters, and maintaining the whole naval umbrella required to defend them, that costs an absolute fortune.
Yes, it does.
And looking at the ISW's breakdown of these negotiations, Iran seems to be keenly aware of that financial and logistical strain on the U.S. The demands Iran is bringing to the table are just audacious.
They really are.
They want to, quote unquote, manage civilian vessels in the Strait of Hormuz and basically charge them what they're calling service fees.
Which the ISW analysts frame as essentially a maritime protection racket.
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like.
It completely contradicts established international maritime law, not to mention direct U.S. policy regarding freedom of navigation. And on top of demanding control over one of the world's most critical shipping lanes, Iran is insisting that half of its frozen international assets be released before any subsequent talks about its nuclear program even start.
So they want the payout up front. And they aren't even selling this to their own people as a lasting peace deal. The ISW notes that Iranian state media is explicitly framing this MOU as a tactical pause.
A pause, not peace.
They are openly communicating to their domestic audience that this agreement is merely a tool to gain economic relief, reconstitute their proxy forces, and drastically reduce U.S. leverage before the real showdown over their nuclear program happens.
Yeah, they're buying time.
They are literally physically digging in while using diplomacy to buy the time to do it.
The report even highlights that they are actively booby-trapping the entrances to their highly enriched uranium storage sites with explosive mines.
And the mechanics of that delay strategy are vital to understand here. By forcing a pause, Iran secures its uranium stockpiles behind physical defenses while simultaneously securing economic lifelines.
It's a win-win for them.
So the obvious question then becomes, why would the U.S. accept an agreement that is so heavily skewed to favor Iran's reconstitution? Well, the hard reality, according to the strategic analysis, is that the U.S. industrial base is basically forcing the administration's hand. Sustaining Operation Epic Fury means intercepting hundreds of Iranian and proxy drones and ballistic missiles. And to do that, the U.S. is burning through its inventory of its highest-end interceptors. We're talking about THAAD systems, Patriot Path 3 missiles, and naval SM-6 interceptors. Let's break down the asymmetry there, because this feels like the absolute crux of the resource drain. A Patriot interceptor isn't just like a dumb rocket filled with explosives.
No, not at all.
It's a kinetic kill vehicle. It uses incredibly advanced radar and thrusters to physically collide with an incoming ballistic missile in the upper atmosphere. It's literally hitting a bullet with a bullet.
Exactly.
And those cost roughly $4 million apiece.
Yeah.
$4 million. And we are firing them to shoot down mass-produced drones that cost maybe $20,000 or $30,000.
Yeah.
The math of this localized fire is just bankrupting the global defensive stockpile.
Which leaves the U.S. deeply vulnerable to the threat that is systematically dismantling the security system outside.
Right? That's the fire analogy.
Exactly. And that outside threat is the modernized industrial war machines of Russia and China.
Okay, but if you're listening to this and remembering the news from, like, 2022 or 2023, you're probably experiencing a bit of whiplash right now.
Oh, definitely.
Because back then, the dominant narrative was that unprecedented international sanctions were just choking the Russian economy.
Right.
I mean, there were stories about Russian forces ripping microchips out of stolen washing machines just to keep their tanks running.
Right. I remember those.
So I have to challenge the premise here. How can a technologically isolated, heavily sanctioned country that's burning through its own working age population realistically threaten the global stockpile of a superpower?
Well, the ISW's latest Russia update addresses that exact contradiction. The narrative of a crumbling Russian economy is just completely outdated at this point.
Really?
Yeah, Russia has systematically restructured its entire economic model. They've placed it on an uncompromising wartime footing. The statistics from the report are frankly staggering.
What are we looking at?
In the first quarter of 2026 alone, Russian military spending hit 5.9 trillion rubles. That accounts for 46% of Russia's entire federal budget. They have essentially bypassed Western sanctions by creating parallel supply chains through allied nations, and they're dedicating almost half their national wealth directly to defense manufacturing.
And that budget allocation is translating into terrifying physical output.
Yeah.
I mean, let's look at the missile math here.
Yeah, the math is bleak.
The ISW details that Russia is now manufacturing 40 to 50 KH-101 cruise missiles and 60 to 70 Iskander-M ballistic missiles every single month. We are talking about over 100 high-end, long-range strike weapons rolling off the assembly lines monthly.
Yes.
And these aren't the rudimentary missiles they were scraping together a few years ago.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
They're continuously iterating on these designs based on real battlefield data.
Right.
The ISW outlines how Russia has actually integrated North Korean ballistic missile technology into the Iskanders to improve their reliability. And for the KH-101 cruise missiles, they have doubled the warhead payload.
Doubled it.
Yeah. And even more concerningly, they've added automatically activating thermal decoys to confuse heat-seeking defenses, and they've integrated terrain scanning navigation.
Now, terrain scanning is a massive leap in lethality.
It really is.
For those who don't know, the missile doesn't just fly a pre-programmed GPS route. It actively reads the topography of the Earth below it.
Right.
This allows the missile to fly incredibly low, dipping through valleys, and basically hiding below the radar horizons of U.S. and allied defense systems.
Yeah.
It gives air defenders only seconds to react before impact.
Exactly. Now, overlay that Russian production rate of over 100 advanced strike missiles a month with the U.S. production of those $4 million PASI-3 Patriot interceptors we discussed earlier.
Okay.
The U.S. industrial base is currently producing roughly 50 Patriot interceptors per month.
Just 50. So the math is undeniable then. Russia is producing twice as many offensive strike weapons as the U.S. is producing the defensive interceptors required to stop them. That is a fundamental structural deficit.
Yeah.
And Ukraine is clearly recognizing this math as well, because according to the ISW, they are no longer just sitting back and trying to absorb these strikes.
Right.
They are conducting intermediate range strikes deep behind Russian lines, actively targeting the precursors to the weapons themselves.
Yeah, the Ukrainian strategy has really shifted to focus on degrading the supply chain before the missiles are ever built.
Makes sense.
The ISW notes recent Ukrainian strikes on the Tamanevtegaz oil terminal to disrupt fuel logistics, and they also hit the massive Crimean Titan factory in occupied Armiansk.
What does that factory make?
It produces raw chemical components that are absolutely vital for manufacturing explosives. But honestly, despite these efforts to choke the supply chain at the source, the sheer volume of Russian state-funded production remains just overwhelming.
And the interconnected nature of all this is where the CSIS report, the one titled Wartime Footing, steps in and sounds a massive alarm.
Yeah, this is the big picture.
Because if Russia is vastly outproducing the U.S. in missile technology, and the U.S. is actively draining its limited stockpiles of Patriot and SM-6 interceptors by fighting an asymmetric drone war against Iran,
right?
What happens when China decides to initiate a blockade or an invasion in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, the CSIS authors drop a very sobering conclusion regarding that exact scenario. Their assessment states, on the record, that the United States has officially lost military overmatch against China in the Western Pacific.
Now, overmatch is a really critical concept here. It doesn't just mean a slight advantage, right?
Oh, no, not at all.
Overmatch is the ability to completely overwhelm an adversary in every domain simultaneously: air, land, sea, cyber, and space. It's the guaranteed dominance the U.S. has largely enjoyed since the end of the Cold War.
Exactly.
And CSIS is stating that this dominance simply no longer exists.
It doesn't. China has rapidly modernized its naval forces, expanded its arsenal of long-range precision anti-ship missiles, and heavily fortified its coastal air defenses. The CSIS analysis argues that traditional U.S. power projection, like, you know, sailing a carrier strike group directly into a conflict zone, is now highly vulnerable.
Too risky.
Yeah, U.S. forward bases, logistics hubs, and surface fleets in the region are at serious risk of being neutralized in the opening hours of a conflict.
So if the traditional model of deterrence by overwhelming force is broken, what is the strategic alternative? The CSIS report advocates for abandoning the peacetime bureaucratic mindset and urgently adopting what they call a two-war construct.
Right.
This means the Pentagon must be actively structured, funded, and prepared to fight two major powers simultaneously. China and the Indo-Pacific is the primary focus, and Russia and Europe is the secondary focus.
Sure.
But I push back on the viability of this.
Okay.
If we don't even have enough interceptors to handle Iran and Russia today, how does just declaring a two-war construct magically fix the deficit against China?
Well, it doesn't magically fix the interceptor deficit. It requires entirely new operational concepts that just don't rely solely on those expensive, depleted interceptors.
So like what?
For the Indo-Pacific theater, CSIS highlights a defense strategy termed the unmanned hellscape.
The unmanned hellscape.
Yes. The premise is that injecting traditional manned ships and large aircraft into the Taiwan Strait during the initial invasion phase is just way too costly in terms of lives and equipment.
Right.
So instead, the U.S. and its allies would basically flood the zone with thousands of advanced, highly autonomous, and relatively low-cost unmanned systems.
Okay, flooding the zone with thousands of drones sounds like a fantastic pitch deck from a Silicon Valley defense startup.
Sure, yeah.
But is the technology actually capable of stopping a mobilized modern Navy? Or is CSIS just hoping software saves the day here? Because a swarm of aerial drones doesn't magically sink a 10,000-ton amphibious assault ship.
Well, the goal of the hellscape isn't necessarily to sink the entire fleet or win the war outright on day one.
Oh, it's not?
No. Yeah. The primary mechanism of the hellscape is disruption and delay. Aerial drones swarm the airspace, blinding the adversary's radar and sensors. Surface drones constantly harass the logistics ships carrying fuel and ammunition. And then underwater unmanned vessels deploy smart mines in the shallow transit corridors. Sheer volume of these autonomous threats forces the invading armada to slow down, expend its own defensive munitions, and constantly maneuver.
So it's a stalling tactic.
Exactly. The CSIS authors estimate this chaotic environment buys the U.S. military approximately 30 days. And that is the critical window of time needed to mobilize heavy bombers, submarines, and long-range assets into the theater safely.
Okay, so it's using mass and autonomy to stall the adversary's momentum. That addresses the primary focus in the Pacific.
Right.
But the two-war construct also requires holding the line in Europe against that massive Russian war economy we discussed earlier. And the CSIS report recommends an updated version of the Cold War air-land battle doctrine for the European theater.
Yeah, and the crux of that European update is a fundamental shift in force posture.
How so?
Well, currently, the U.S. relies heavily on rotating armored brigades through Eastern Europe. You know, a unit deploys for 9 months, then goes home, and another takes its place.
Right, rotational deployments.
Exactly. But CSIS argues this model is entirely inadequate against a fully mobilized Russia. Transporting heavy armor across the Atlantic or rail loading it across Europe takes weeks.
And we wouldn't have weeks.
Exactly. In a crisis involving the Baltic states or Poland, weeks are something NATO simply does not have. So their recommendation is to permanently base heavy U.S. armored brigades directly in Eastern Europe. The tanks remain parked, fueled, and manned just miles from the potential front line.
But the report also acknowledges a pretty harsh reality regarding the size of the U.S. military, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Even with permanent basing, the U.S. simply does not have the sheer number of active duty troops required to maintain a massive ground presence in Europe while simultaneously fighting a high-tech naval and air war in the Pacific.
Right, the numbers just aren't there.
So the CSIS strategy functionally relies on European NATO allies stepping up to provide the bulk of the traditional infantry mass and localized artillery.
Exactly.
This theoretically allows the U.S. to pivot its specialized units and focus on providing the high-end enablers, things like stealth air superiority, deep-strike cruise missiles, and satellite intelligence.
Right, but that brings the entire analysis right back to the most alarming bottleneck of all, the defense industrial base.
Always back to the supply chain.
Always.
Yeah.
Because the strategies outlined, whether it's the unmanned hellscape in the Pacific or the permanent armored deterrence in Europe, they rely entirely on actually having the physical tools ready to go.
Right.
And the CSIS report issues a very stark warning that the U.S. industrial base is currently operating at a peacetime bureaucratic pace. For critical munitions, including the solid rocket motors required for long-range anti-ship missiles, the supply chain is incredibly fragile.
Wow.
The report calculates that it takes 2 to 4 years to produce sufficient stockpiles for a protracted great power conflict.
2 to 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is easily the most sobering number in this entire stack of sources today.
I mean, right.
Because if a major conflict breaks out tomorrow, the U.S. fights with the inventory currently sitting in the bunkers. There is no rapid surge capacity that can just magically materialize complex precision weapons overnight.
Yep.
And right now, the inventory in those bunkers is being loaded onto aircraft and fired from destroyers in the Middle East to fend off proxy attacks.
Yeah, every SM-6 missile fired to protect a commercial freighter in the Red Sea, every Patriot launched to defend a base from an Iranian drone, is one less interceptor available for potential crisis in the Taiwan Strait or the Suwalki Gap.
Right.
The tactical distractions in the Middle East are eating directly into the strategic timeline required to build deterrence against China and Russia.
So let's pull all of these threads together, because the picture these analysts paint is a pretty profound shift from how we usually consume the news.
It really is.
We started by looking at the gritty, localized reality of Operation Epic Fury battle-scarred A-10s flying low-altitude rescue missions and the U.S. burning millions of dollars a day to maintain a protective umbrella over the Middle East.
Right, and then we explored how Iran is actively leveraging that exact financial strain. They're using the promise of a tactical pause to secure their uranium facilities and extract economic concessions, fully aware that the U.S. desperately needs to redirect its focus.
Meanwhile, ISW data shows Russia has basically transformed almost half of its national budget into a wartime manufacturing engine, producing advanced terrain-scanning missiles at double the rate the U.S. can build the interceptors to stop them.
Yeah.
And all of this culminates in the CSIS assessment that the U.S. has lost its global overmatch.
Exactly.
And their proposed solution is a brutal prioritization. Adopt a two-war construct. Rely on drones to stall in the Pacific, rely on NATO allies to provide the ground mass in Europe, and fundamentally restructure the defense industrial base.
So, for you listening, the core takeaway here is a fundamental paradigm shift in understanding modern geopolitics.
Right.
A localized, tactical victory-like, successfully defending a remote outpost or intercepting a drone swarm can actually result in a massive global vulnerability if achieving that victory drains the specialized, irreplaceable resources you need to deter a superpower.
It's all connected. You cannot focus purely on the kitchen fire without realizing your home security system is being dismantled outside.
Perfectly said.
Which leaves me with one final lingering thought for you to chew on as we wrap up today. We've spent a lot of time exploring how this new axis shares equipment and technology, right?
Right.
We see North Korean ballistic tech integrated into Russian Iskander missiles and Iranian drone schematics being mass-produced for use in European skies. But if this alliance deepens over the next few years to counter the U.S.'s two-war construct, what happens if they start sharing more than just blueprints and hardware?
Oh.
What happens if they start sharing actual combat forces across theaters in a coordinated simultaneous offensive?
I mean, the prospect of multinational adversary forces fighting under unified command across different continents, that would test the limits of Western logistics in ways we haven't seen since the 1940s.
Exactly. If a conflict breaks out in the Pacific or a border is crossed in Eastern Europe, who else might suddenly show up on the battlefield? It is absolutely something to keep in mind the next time you see a headline about a seemingly isolated, far-off conflict. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today. We'll catch you next time.